I love a good mashup. You know, where you take two or more disparate things and bring them together to make something distinct on its own. We see it all the time with food and playlists. A chocolate milkshake and fries, strawberries and balsamic vinegar, the Bee Gees with Pink Floyd, Earth, Wind & Fire with Ozzy Osbourne. And yes, those last two things are real. Look them up. I love a good mashup in a law practice, too. But a lot of lawyers and law firms struggle with how to market seemingly disparate practices. They think that because the two areas don't nicely fit together, that's a problem. Here's why strange law combos work. First, they are memorable. I know this because right now you are still thinking about the Bee Gees, Pink Floyd, Earth, Wind & Fire, and Ozzy. Admit it. Second, they are authentic. It's rare that a lawyer conjures up two unrelated practice areas and decides to pursue both of them. There's usually a story that's personal to the attorney. It could be based on how they grew up, the family business, pre-law experience, or an interest that turns into a business opportunity. Show me an attorney with a uniquely memorable and uniquely authentic brand, and I'll show you a sticky lawyer. The practice of law often involves artistry, sometimes even performance art. Today's guest has channeled her performing arts background into her own memorable, authentic brand. Miami attorney Salem R. Pucho has devoted much of her life to ballet, and as a lawyer, she now counsels dancers, choreographers, and others in the industry on legal matters involving, and here's the mashup, immigration and intellectual property. I'm looking forward to having her explain how the combination is working for her. Cielo, buenos dias. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Let's start with your ballet background. Tell us about your ballet career first.
Okay, well, I'm not a regular ballet dancer. I didn't start, like everyone assumes, very small. I did start dancing when I was around 12 years of age. And when you need to become a professional by the age of 18, starting at 12, it's already a little late. In ballet, you need to be very flexible and have extraordinary dancing conditions, which you could only achieve by time. So starting at 12, being already a little bit developed, it's hard to get to those conditions. Now, many people have gotten them, but in my case, it was hard. I loved dancing. I still dance, but it has always been something that I struggled. It's hard for me to do. And I think that is why I like it, because it doesn't come easy for me. So I started dancing by the age of 12, like I said. And by the time of 18, when I need to do the jump to professional, I didn't. I just decided to keep dancing as a hobby and just go another professional, let's say, regular route.
But to be fair, give yourself some credit here. It's not like you're only, you know, dancing in the studio and taking classes. You're still performing. You have been performing with companies for, well, I would imagine all of your dancing career.
Well, yes. I have done many performances with many different careers. I am technically now preparing myself to do an appearance in the Nutcracker in a small school here in Miami. So yes, I still perform and I love it. It's something that I love to do. I just didn't do the jump to become a professional dancer. Let's say it that way.
Sure. You know, we talk to a lot of guests who are involved in a community, either because they're in an industry where it's rather insular, or their hobby keeps them within a small group, or the nature of their practice is tailored to a particular group of individuals. I would imagine, because of most of your lifelong involvement in dance, that provides you instant credibility with the dance community, as opposed to somebody that's coming from the outside who doesn't necessarily speak the language of dance, you know, doesn't understand the environment of dance. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, of course. Since I've been dancing all my life, and it's fair to say that, yes, I have done ballet, but I have done other areas in dance. Mm-hmm. I have danced ballroom dancing, jazz, contemporary. So I have done plenty in the dance industry. I've also been a receptionist for a dance school. I've done performances, helped assistant in creating performances. So there's a wide variety of dancing experience that I have, and in that field, in many different aspects. And that gives me an edge, a knowledge that I have amongst other attorneys that maybe have no idea of what they do. So yes, when a dancer come to me and they have a legal issue, I know how to solve it because I know her or his background in dance and, of course, the legal background. And actually, that's how my company started, with having someone reaching out to me because of that unique expertise that I could offer her.
So let's go back and talk about the origins of your legal career. So you made the decision, or maybe the decision was made for you, not to make that jump professionally in dance. When you made the decision not to pursue it, what was next? What was college? What was law school?
Well, I didn't start thinking about going to law school. I did my bachelor's in advertising and public relations. I worked a year and a half, almost 2 years, in a big advertising firm in Puerto Rico. That's where I'm from. And I was looking to do something else, either pursuing a master's in advertising or doing something else, but I didn't want it to stay that way. And for some reason that is still unknown this day to me, my grandfather, since I was little, was always telling me, you know, you're going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a lawyer. And it's very funny because he's not a lawyer. He's an accountant. No one in my family is an attorney. No one, not a cousin, no one. My parents are actually doctors. So I didn't understand why he wanted for me to do that. But when that time came, I said, you know what? Why don't I pursue law? Maybe he was right. Maybe he saw something in me. And that's how I started law school. I applied and I luckily entered to the school that I wanted in Puerto Rico and I studied law. So that's how my career in law started. Now, all of this time, I kept dancing. I have to say that. Never stopped dancing.
Dance has become your outlet. Is that correct?
Yes. Especially in those hard times in law, because of course, studying law was very hard for me. I come first. I'm very extroverted and I like to perform. So I like to act. When I did advertising, it's something that you get together, you create ideas. It's very creative, very acting upon. When I started law, it's sitting down with thousands and thousands of books and reading quietly. So definitely, I have to say it was challenging for me at the beginning. And I needed a break from that. And dancing was that outlet. It was something that passionated me and that I can move and do something that I was used to doing.
One would think, based on your own admission of being extroverted and wanting to perform and be out there, that litigation would have been your calling. When you were in law school, what were you thinking you were going to do with your law degree and your law practice?
When I was in college and having parents that are doctors and thinking about litigation, yes, of course, my aim was always litigation. And I was thinking maybe going on the medical malpractice route in Puerto Rico. That's a very big field and it has to be a lot of litigation in the federal arena. So it's something really good for attorneys there. And curiously, when I took my class in criminal law, the professor thought that I would be good in criminal law. So also we're talking about the litigation area. I never thought of doing something passive. It was always around the litigation area. Yes.
So you got your law degree, admitted to the bar, and I want to talk about that in a minute. What was your first job in the practice?
While I was studying, I did some work as a law clerk and assistant for some attorneys. They were usually in the contract side, in the civil side. I did my practice in law school in civil, and we did a litigation of a case. So that was something really good, again, because my aim was a litigation. But it always happens to when you start looking for a job, you more or less have to adapt to what appears out there. And what appeared to me was to work assisting a very important family law attorney in Puerto Rico. So that's what I started in the family area. Now, there's a lot of litigation there, divorces, custodies, alimony. So yes, I started in litigation, but in that area, in family law.
So what came first, your first dancer client or the opening of your own law practice?
My first dancing client.
Okay.
Because what happened was, all of this is in Puerto Rico. But 10 years ago, I got married to a North American that lived here in Miami. And that's where I went from being in Puerto Rico to coming to Miami. Now, I had my practice in Puerto Rico around estate planning, around family law. But coming to Miami, I am not barred in Florida. I'm still not barred in Florida. So I had to look something else. So I started looking into the federal area, which I could with my Puerto Rico bar. And that's where I started practicing in immigration. And you know that one of the areas in immigration is visas. And I continued taking my dance classes always. And my teacher knew that I was a attorney. And she had an extraordinary ability dancer with her that was having issues with her visa. And she told in front of the class, you know what? Why don't you go to Cielo? She is an attorney and she's one of us. And that was my light bulb moment.
Okay.
That is what I should do. I should create a practice in which I could combine my knowledge of dancing and my knowledge of law and, as an extra benefit, help and aid this dancing community, which I love and I've been part of for so long.
So prior to that moment, when somebody else declared that you were the go-to person, it hadn't occurred to you before to tailor your practice, to bring your law practice and your passion for dance together?
Really, it hadn't. I have to admit that I was looking into, since I studied advertising and public relations, I was looking also, and I did like it, enjoyed it, and I knew about trademarks and copyright law. I was looking of maybe adding that into my practice. But I've never looked at just tailoring my practice to an audience.
Hmm. You mentioned that you were initially licensed in Puerto Rico. And for the majority of people listening to this, I don't think people would understand the distinction between practicing in Puerto Rico and practicing in a U.S. state. Talk to us about the difficulties you had and what you did. I believe you're also licensed in the District of Columbia, and why you did that and what was the impetus for that.
Yes. Well, the Puerto Rico situation is very difficult. And if we were discussing this topic in Puerto Rico, it would be even really hard because everyone has an opinion. And in Puerto Rico, we are very adamant, our opinion, and wanted to stand by. But technically, in the legal area, even though Puerto Rico is a territory, think about it, having a license of another state of the country. Now, again, having and wanted to litigate. When I started in immigration law, what I did was I worked a lot in the removal proceedings area, specifically going to various different detained centers, representing clients there, all around the nation. Mm-hmm. So usually when you go to the detained center, there's usually someone there. You tell them, I want to see my client. You put your bar and they let you in. And that's when I saw the lack of knowledge of people about what the Puerto Rico bar was. In many situations there, I encountered many officers that didn't understand but that Puerto Rico is also like a license of any other state. Mm-hmm. And they would tell me, no, you cannot see the client because you're not an American attorney or you don't have an American bar, you're an international. And it's not true. Mm-hmm. And because I encountered that a lot and sometimes even questions from clients, but are you barred in the U.S.? Because you said Puerto Rico. Yes, but even though we're a territory, it is part of the United States in that area. Mm-hmm. Our university is an American Bar Association university accredited. Mm-hmm. Because of that is that I decided to become licensed in the District of Columbia to try to maybe don't go through that, even though I love explaining when the people give me the chance. But when it comes hard, okay, you don't want to accept my Puerto Rico bar? Here is my Washington, D.C. bar, the capital. So what are you going to say now?
So you're official. You were official before.
I am official.
But now you're really official.
Yes, I am.
That's another thing I think a lot of people may not understand, at least non-lawyers listening to this, is the idea of a federal practice as opposed to a state practice. And immigration and, for the most part, intellectual property. There are some state issues involved with certain elements of IP. But those two things, for the most part, are governed by federal law, which allows you to practice in federal courts across the country.
Yes, and I want to make that clear for other attorneys. I do, when I create my contracts, I let the client know that I am licensed in those states And what I'm going to touch is based on those states. And that I live in Miami, Florida, I am not bar in Florida because I want to be ethically correct all the time.
Sure.
And like you said, the majority of those fields, you work in the federal arena where there's an issue that is going to involve state. I just step back and I have a bunch of referrals, which I could refer my client to not get into that dilemma that, of course, I don't want it to.
Let's dive a little bit deeper into your two practice areas. Immigration is a very charged word these days in the public discourse, of course. In terms of your immigration practice and working with artists, define your immigration practice.
Okay. Well, I have worked for other attorneys and I have done many things in immigration. But when it comes to my practice, first of all, I like to focus like in a boutique style practice in which maybe I have to admit to my colleagues it's not that cost efficient. But I do everything with my client because I enjoy it. That is my outlet for enjoyment and to do something that I really do like. So I deal with the client myself. I don't even have a secretary and I limit it to what I do very, very closely. I do basically what is the O's, the P's and the EB visas. So it's going to be literally dealing with extraordinary ability clients, international recognized groups, culturally unique groups in the field of artistry, specifically dancing. Yes, I've had clients and consultations of other things, but I stick to artists, specifically ballet. So it's something very, very limited that I do. As you can see, it's not litigation for the majority. If I need to litigate or appeal any case, I refer it out. So now I do a lot of more paperwork, but it's basically that. OPs and EBs and maybe NIW. But again, it's visas. Getting visas for my clients in extraordinary ability because of their expertise in arts.
Does your work also extend to family members? So maybe assisting with spouses or partners or children coming to the U.S. as well?
Yes. So all of this, spouses, children, and any aid that they need, maybe someone that is going to do makeup for them or help them, all of them are along and they're supplemental to the O visa. So it's going to be, if the primary is O1, these are going to be O2 or O3. So yes, I work with them all along because they are inside these categories.
I'm curious in terms of how you're sourcing your work. Unquestionably, a lot of it is referrals just because you work with people and they talk and Cielo is the person to go to. That's fantastic. Do you have relationships with dance companies, with agents, with people that work with the performers? Is that part of your network as well?
I do. And I actually represent a company, a dance company in Puerto Rico. And also dancers. Yeah. Like you said, word of mouth. If I get a visa for a client and he comes to the United States, he lets the owner of the company, let's say, know how they got their visa. Or I also work with them because if they're going to be the petitioner, so that way they get knowledge of me, the school, the company. I also have a friend that does PR for some dance companies and she knows about me. And yes, so word of mouth. But I have to say, social media has helped a lot. There are people that have found me in social media. Hey, I saw your profile. So you're an attorney, but dance, I don't understand. You explain to them and they then say, oh, I need someone to help me there. I also like volunteering. I volunteer in Centers for Art Law. Yes, they work more with what is the fine arts, but I also volunteer in other places. I like to volunteer. There's many people in this area that they don't have the resources. It's something that we need to say, you know, the clientele and my audience is resource limited. We dancers are not millionaires and we do not get paid millions of dollars. So I like to help and I do take even pro bono cases if I think they are merited.
Mm-hmm. You've also been published in a few different places. You've written articles. What's interesting to me, of course, I have a marketing undergrad. Before I went to law school, you have advertising. So you and I, we speak that same language, which is great. And so you've obviously embraced this idea of promoting your practice. You understand your brand. When you write articles and you submit them to these publications and they're industry publications, have you found that your contributions, your thought leadership is more readily accepted by these publishers because you are one of them? You come from the dance community?
I really don't have an answer for that. I want to say that when I reach out to them, they maybe see some kind of acknowledgement in me. But even though through the process, they're very rigorous of what needs to be submitted or not. So maybe yes, but still they're quite rigorous, specifically when I've written to specialized industries, because I assume that everyone that reach out is specialized also. Different if I reach out to a more commercial magazine, but if it's something that is in, for example, I like to write for dancing magazines related with dance. I assume that everyone that reach out maybe are also expert in the subject, so they are gonna be very rigorous. Mm. What I have seen is sometimes those magazines reaching out to me so that I can speak out about what I know, which I find quite interesting, that they were the one that reached out to me.
Sure. So you didn't get a pass just because you are a dancer. You had to know what you were talking about. But you've built the relationships and delivered quality content, so now they're reaching out to you asking for contributions.
Exactly. That's what I think I could say. Yeah.
Okay. Let's switch and talk about your trademark and copyright practice, because I find this fascinating. First off, again, to be clear, I say intellectual property. You don't do anything on the hard side, the patent work. We're talking about the softer, what we call the soft IP, the trademark copyright.
That's correct.
I think a lot of people would understand copywriting a musical work, a song, or trademarking, you know, a logo or something like that. How do trademarks and copyrights come into play with your dance clientele?
Well, copyright, it's easier than trademark because it's not only copywriting a song, but it's a piece of dance, a dancing piece or a whole ballet performance. And as dancers, we get hired many times to work for a school or to work for a dance company. And when you read those contracts, among the work that you're going to do is choreograph pieces. So yes, they're always the clause of work for hire, but if there's not that clause, or if that clause could be studied and are things that could be fixed, there's always the argument or the issue that choreography was done by me and I own it, so I could register or I can protect it. Or maybe I could sell it to you, but just during a period of time. So the copyright issue, I've been addressed by many dancers that are also choreographers. And this is the argument that we get into. What do you sign, or how do you want to sign it if before they haven't signed it? Mm-hmm. Or what do you want back? And we know that this is something really big. George Balanchine, as we all know, did many pieces, many wonderful pieces during his time. And now there's a foundation of the pieces. And if you want to perform any of his pieces, you need to go through the foundation, get their authorization, pay an amount of money. And this is all because of copyright law. So this is very important for dancers, and dancers need to be aware of this. There's been some other contributions. I should have looked for this name, but Jackal Knight, I think he is the one. He's the one that got the copyright of Single Ladies.
For Beyonce.
Yes, Jackal Knight. So he's a choreographer, and he is one of the big voices out there creating awareness for choreographers on what you are worth and how you should copyright and protect your work. Remember, if I am a choreographer and I do a piece for a company and maybe they paid me for that piece $1,500, you could say that upfront that looks like good amount of money, especially in the dance industry. But how many times can they repeat that piece? And for how many years if you gave out your rights? So he is one of the persons creating awareness. He's a choreographer also about, hey, we need to copyright our work and protect it. And he has done a platform with help of some others to make this an easier process, because copywriting a piece of work of dance is not easy. Why? Because remember, you need to follow an annotation system, mm-hmm. because it has been done in a way that someone else can look at it and reproduce it. So So it's easy a song, you write it down. But how are you going to write a dance? You know, that's when it comes a little bit more complicated.
And that's a great example. So I think probably, well, maybe everybody listening to this will have seen the Beyonce video. It's not just the movement of the hand in Single Ladies that is copyrightable. It has to be the entire body of movements, if you, no pun intended, the movements that make up that entire piece that is copyrightable. I guess my question is, how much do you need in terms of different movements to reach that threshold?
That's a very, very good question. Because in the past, and how the evolution of copywriting dance work has been, you had to have like this whole story, and it has to have some kind of elaboration. But what happened? TikTok happened. And now there are this burst of 30-second dances. So again, this is something that is evolving all the time. This is why these nuances need an attorney, because it will depend on how unique, how artistic it is, and how much you can do in those 30 seconds. So I don't want to give this answer because it's a very lawyery answer, but it all depends.
Certainly.
But this is what we're moving towards. And this is also why this area is so interesting and so changing, because it has to change with what is happening in our world. And social media, especially COVID, we know that has changed the way that we see our world, definitely.
Talk to us about how the pandemic affected your practice.
When the pandemic hit, you know that everything was closed and people had to reinvent themselves. And what better way to reinvent yourself when you're a dancer? You're a creative. That's what you're doing all the time. So this pushed dancers to do something for money. The majority of the dancers, even though they have a contract, you get paid per performance usually. There's exception, but that's the usual way to get paid. So what now if you're not going to have a performance? Not only that, how am I going to train if I don't have the studio to go to? I need to keep my body training. So that's where dancers evolved to looking for different outlets to train and to doing alternative dance-related careers. So let's call it that way. So many of them, what they did is go look a space in your house, and maybe through Zoom, through social media, start giving classes. And maybe I charge a little for that classes. And that's how I start making money. Others went a completely different route. So I know of some business owners that what they did was, you know what? People still need to buy their point shoes. And we that use point shoes know that you need to try them on to see if they're comfortable, if they are what you want. So how am I cannot go to the store. Well, there's these people that started creating minivans, or instead of foot trucks, point trucks, so that they can go towards you and you can then try up the point shoes and wear them. Others did, you know what? Let me do subscription boxes, different subscription boxes with articles and things that dancers will need and send them to them. And that way we can limit the contact with each other and still do something profitable. So all of these new small businesses started emerging, some of them so profitable that even when the COVID restrictions stopped and everyone reopened, some of them stayed. They continued dancing, but stayed with those businesses. Some of them retired and continued with those businesses. But now there's all these small businesses. So what are you going to do? One of the most important things to do for any small business, including dancers that do this, is trademark your name. Okay, because it's like your name. You have a name. You want it to be unique. Yes, sometimes our name is not so unique. But you want your business then to have a unique name so that everyone out there can recognize that that is you. And no consumer can be confused. Oh, I thought I bought the shoes from this place, but it's really this other place. And now I don't like it. The quality is bad, et cetera, et cetera. Especially if it is a business that grew on social media. So all eyes are going to be on it. There's going to be many people that wanted to maybe resemble you. Well, it is important to trademark. So that's how this area of trademark is also related to dancing.
So it sounds like your trademark work, not that it was non-existent before, but the pandemic it exploded because of all these new ventures that the dancers were getting involved in to make money because they couldn't perform.
Yes, yes. And it was not non-existent because there always have been. I have wonderful clients that were former dancers and that they still, like me, like dance. So they created businesses around the dancing arena. And they are dancers, so they understand that. And they reach out to me because of my expertise in that area or because of my experience in that area.
Sure. And you're very clear. You've been very clear thus far about what you don't do. You've decided to focus on, and not just ethically, but as a conscious business decision, you've decided to focus on immigration and trademark and copyright. But you've also talked about employment contracts and how they may not suitably provide for created works. There's also these companies that have started. You're not handling those things, right? So if it's going to be a transactional matter or employment or tax or family law or whatever, even though your client is coming to you, you're not going to handle that.
Yes. I can, of course, guide him towards a referral, a base that I have. And I have referrals in many different places. And they could handle them. If and only if the issues in Puerto Rico, since my studies are from there, my bar is from there, that's where I then could access that part. Having said that, again, my mindset and my business is on the federal trademark copyright area, not on the employment side. So I prefer referring those out, even if it's in Puerto Rico.
Sure.
It's better for me.
Sure. I often ask this question, I'll ask it of you. What are your greatest hits? You know, you've had success in your practice. Success means different things to different people. Tell us a couple stories about matters you've handled or people you've represented, not naming names, of which you're particularly proud, the work that you've done that you're particularly proud of.
Well, I really have a client that is very dear to my heart because he became a friend after, and we did an O-1B visa, the visa specifically for artists. And he came from Mexico, and we wanted to bring him here to the United States, and he was going to become, in the United States, the job opportunity that he had, it was going to be a very big jump to what he was doing, not only because it was going to be a huge title, but because he was going to be leading one of the most prestigious dance company here in the United States. And the visa took time because we were going to have to go through many documents. We have to search through all his life. It wasn't something so clear cut that, oh, I have this award, I have an Emmy or a Grammy. I know they don't apply for dancers, but let's imagine. So it's an easy go-to. No, it was something that we needed to really search and really provide this life book to the officer so that when he evaluated everything, he ruled in favor of us. So the producing time only and the preparation was 6 to 8 months. Even though it was long, again, because of my boutique approach, it was a very satisfying process through me. I got to know him. So we become friends. And it's something that it's always very nice to have when that client becomes already a friend. And then when we submitted, in less than 2 weeks, we got an approval. So that was also very satisfying that in a very short time, we got that approval, even though the work took so long. And it has been a client that has been with me along the way. Since we are already friends, I now take classes with him sometimes. I go see him, you see?
Yeah.
So the relationship evolves. So that one particular client, not only because of the work satisfaction, it has been very satisfying for me because of that area. And something that you said, I think it's really important. I know that us attorneys, if we measure maybe success of a business in regular business terms, but I think that it's also really important. And in this world, when you're seeing so much things, the war in Ukraine, now in Israel, to measure success in some other ways that could be very satisfying to our soul. I think that's something important to consider. And I see that there's many attorneys considering success in others' way. And I applaud that. And I applaud that. And in this case, even though we had the success professionally, I could say that my greatest success was having him now as a friend.
Good, good, good. And maybe in the trademark area, something else you've done that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I was really particularly proud to having trademarked a brand of a former ballerina and that she had a career after retiring. She had developed all of this and a business in relation to dancing. So it was really nice to achieve her. We achieved also her trademark registration, and also my relationship with her is very pleasurable. You see, that's what I like. Not only the work that I'm doing and the work that is related with something that I like, which is dancing, but also that since we have things in common, we kind of understand each other. It's like when you meet someone for the first time and something clicks, it's like having that feeling with my clients. Now, I'm not going to tell you that there have been clients that are difficult, yeah, or that maybe not difficult because I don't like using that word.
No, tell me it isn't so.
Having clients that maybe don't see eye to eye to what you're doing, or discrepancies, and then you have to part ways. But I like also to concentrate in the positive, because we also as attorney know that there are always those clients.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that. I won't say anything more. I applaud you for a number of reasons that you've so clearly articulated. You have a focus in terms of what you want your practice to be. You clearly have done your advertising. Professor's proud in that you've concentrated so heavily on your brand and you understand it and it's crystallized. You fully promote it. But I thank you for sharing how you measure and gauge success, that it is that personal relationship. You know, part of what we do on this podcast is we spotlight remarkable attorneys like yourself, not only for what they do, but what they get out of the practice. And so I appreciate you kind of explaining that for us. You and I had the opportunity to talk before, and we talked about this idea that even though you are a specialist, and I use that in the common English term, not the legal ethics term, because we know that's dangerous. But even though you concentrate in particular areas, you strive to be your client's first call. So it'd be great if they called you with an immigration issue or a trademark issue or a copyright issue that you could immediately help with. But in a lot of cases, people are calling you because they have a family law issue or a criminal matter or something like that. Talk to us about being that first point of contact for your clients, how you cultivate that and how you take care of them when they do call with an issue that's not in your wheelhouse.
Okay, well, first of all, I think that, like you said, branding is very important. So that's why I try to stick everything and really niche out so that when people reach out to me, they're basically already know because of what I put out there, the niche that I work with. So maybe someone in criminal area will not call me, and I don't recommend calling me because you're going to stay in jail. I'm not the best one for that at all. But again, if by any chance there's a person that reach out to me, there's various ways to go. Depending on the relationship that I see with the client, I could refer them out if I see that there's someone that has the knowledge, or because ethically I cannot help them if it's something state or something like that. Or yes, again, since the practice is mine and it's very boutique, I could, if I feel that I have the capacity to take the case and the expertise to take the case. Again, I was reached out one time by a client, a dancer, still dancer, in which we were thinking about the O visa in immigration. While I talked to her and evaluated her case and we kept talking, I saw that I didn't think she was a candidate for that. But I also don't like saying no and leaving the client there. I like trying to provide solutions. And my law firm in this time is a part-time job that I do. So I do work for other attorneys. So I have experience in other cases. So and in other things, this is just what I like my practice to be. But because of my past experience, I have some knowledge and expertise in immigration, family immigration. And I thought that the best way to go was through a family immigration proceedings. So I let her know. And because of my relation with her, I took the case. So that is one of those cases that is outside of what my scope really is, but that I took it. And also, having telling you about my experience and what I do with dancers, I have been reached out by people, maybe sports, maybe in the fine arts. And again, depending of my experience with them, how our conversations goes, it could be that I could take the case. If not, I never like saying no. I like to refer out. So I do have attorneys that I know in different areas, and I always like to refer. I don't like having the client say, you know, say no, I'm sorry, and go away. I also always let them the door open. If by any chance the referral that I send you doesn't work out or something happened, well, you can come back to me and I can see if I could reach out to someone else, etc. That's something that I like to do.
Sure. It's a care and concern that's part of your ongoing part of your practice.
I think that it's very important also to see the client as a person that's coming to you with a problem.
So tell us, what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to give you a nugget.
Okay.
Recently, in September, it was the UNGA, the United Nations Conferences for Science. I do have a trademark client pro bono that he is trying to achieve food in space. But I don't know if you know that I'm working my master's in archaeology. That's something else that I dabble into, cultural heritage, because those have to do with the arts and things like that. There's many art lawyers that also do cultural heritage. So that's also something that I dabble into. But I was helping and working alongside this attorney that she does cultural heritage in space. And I wanted to do something art related, of course, and the artist. And we did reach out to some artists and we did the subject in the UNGA, United Nations Conference on Arts in Space.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. So that is my new rabbit hole that I fell through. So I am trying now to get my knowledge out there, get more involved in this area. Again, because I want to be the go-to attorney for artists, specifically ballet, you know, so they can think of me. And I want to then also cover not so much cultural heritage. I want to stick to art, but cover art in space. So that is also something that I'm going to be recently adding. I have a good chat on Monday with my mentor in that area, which she is basically the authority in that subject. So that's something new that I'm going to be adding to my practice. I haven't said it and nowhere, but it's something that I'm moving forward my practice to also add. Again, not leaving out anything, but to also add, because there is abundance of things that are happening in space that we are not aware of, including art. Beautiful things of arts that are going out there. And when I'm talking also of art in outer space, it's literally the art either being done in outer space or being done here and launched to outer space. So yeah, I encountered an artist that did like something with flowers and he launched it and it got all the way to the ISSA until it crumbled. And we have the photographs, and now the photographs went to a gallery, and then they went to auction, you know. So there's a lot of things that are happening. So I want to have also that outlet there, especially because when I talked to my mentor, she told me there's very little in this. So it could be a good area for me to go into. I'm already writing some articles to see if it could be published on them. So something new, you're the only one that know it.
Oh my goodness.
That I'll be adding to the practice.
Okay. All right. Well, Cielo Mar, Cielo, it has been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate your energy and your spirit, and you've delivered a masterclass in niche marketing for lawyers. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity, and it has been a pleasure.
To our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Cielo, visit stickylawyers.com, where we've posted links to her law firm and other sites. Regardless of where you found us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, etc., please take a moment to hit the follow button. That way you'll be sure to get new episodes, and you'll also let us know that you're a fan, and we would definitely appreciate that. Until next time, I'm John Reed, and you've been listening to Sticky Lawyers.